Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me? I check my mailbox every day for any sugar you send my way.
Welcome back. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Cheryl.
Here we are with another episode of Dear Sugar Radio. This week, we're going to talk about deal killers, the things that make it impossible for one to go on in a romantic relationship or maybe even begin one. There is sort of a little game that Brian, my husband, Mr. Sugar, plays with me. We've been together 19 years. And on a weekly basis, just out of the blue, he'll say to me, "What if everything were the same about me, but I developed an interest in collecting porcelain dolls? Would you still love me?"
Oh my God, I would love him so much more. So, what's the impulse behind that? I think it's such a kinky and odd thing to do.
It is actually kind of interesting because, you know, obviously, you know, we're being funny, but in the course of our 19 years together, one of the things that we've done as we've gone deeper and deeper into our relationship is we've seen all the different faces of each other.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's been full of struggle and hardship. And I remember at one point, and I wrote about this in a sugar letter, about a time that we dealt with infidelity.
Right.
That Brian had been unfaithful to me and we worked it out. And one of the things that he was so surprised by is that I still loved him.
Right.
And we've gone down all kinds of different avenues in the course of our relationship and our marriage. And you know, there is, I think, sometimes this sense of like, will you still love me if I do this? Will you still love me if I do that?
Right.
And, you know, obviously, any deep relationship, the answer has to be yes. You have to really love somebody totally to truly love them. And at the same time, there are things that would kill the deal.
That's right. What are the limits of love? What are the limits of love? And in a way, Brian is enacting a kind of question of sort of like, okay, everything's the same. We've got our thing. Where's the line? It's kind of a playful way of dealing with an anxiety that I think people are struggling with all the time. What is the limit of how much you'll love me? How much of my private self, of my crazy, of my neuroses, of my squirreled away illicit thoughts and behaviors?
Right. I think that that is a great lead into our first question of the episode, which is really a pretty serious one.
It is one that is near and dear to my heart. Dear Sugar, my boyfriend suffers from anxiety, the big kind with a fancy diagnosis and a pharmacy of pills. While he has had neuroses his entire life, like most of us, it's only been the past year that they have totally taken over. The reason I am writing to you is because I'm struggling to maintain patience, kindness, and love throughout this hard time. When we met, he was confident, sexy, charming, maybe even a little cocky. Now he can hardly get through a casual dinner with friends. He gets so worked up. He thinks medication is the only solution, and he is largely resistant to the idea that more holistic forms of stress relief, like exercise and journaling, could help him. In other words, any input I've had on the issue has been largely rejected and taken personally. After months of talking him down, my mind has turned dark. He comes from a fairly privileged background and still receives financial assistance from his parents, so there hasn't been a great deal of hardship in his life. As we plan a future together, I worry about his reaction to the big problems we will inevitably have to deal with, losing loved ones, losing jobs, surly children, what have you. I worry that he won't ever really be able to stand up and be strong. I worry my own struggles will never have room in our relationship because they could never measure up to his big darkness. I love him, and there is so much good in him and in our life together, but I'm struggling. The worst part is he knows I'm struggling, and so has started to largely keep this aspect of his life from me for fear of disappointing me. How terrible am I? How can I be better? Sincerely, struggling.
How terrible is she?
I don't think she's terrible. I think she's trying to be honest about something that is terribly difficult. She feels trapped. I mean, she's on the horns of a real dilemma. Her real fear is of his weakness and how strong she's going to have to be in order to be in the relationship. And this anxiety of, you know, my struggles are going to get overlooked because the big show here is that you are this anxious person. It sounds like he's, you know, sort of a big personality who, when he's up, he's the center of attention. And when he's down, he's the center of attention. I thought a lot about this story, the depressed person, the famous David Foster Wallace story. And I think a lot about David Foster Wallace because he's somebody who was profoundly depressed throughout his life, and yet somehow through his writing was able to be so compassionate and attentive and focused on the world. It's almost what rescued him. So here's the depressed person. And she's talking to a friend of hers who's mortally ill. But of course, the depressed person is focused on herself. She was asking sincerely, the depressed person said, honestly, desperately, what kind of person could seem to feel nothing, nothing, she emphasized, for anyone but herself. She wept into the headset telephone and said she was shamelessly begging her now single most valuable friend and confidant in the world to share her brutally candid assessment, to pull no punches, to say nothing reassuring. What terms might be used to describe and assess such a solipsistic, self-consumed, bottomless emotional vacuum and sponge as she now appeared to herself to be? That's what she's saying, essentially, is I'm worried that I am trapped with somebody whose mental illness, whose mental struggles are literally going to make the focus of the relationship him and his troubles, rather than creating a life together. There's nothing terrible in that. What's terrible, in fact, is that it seems to me they're hiding from each other.
I really see a lot of strength, a lot of great boundaries in this letter writer. You know, she has compassion for her partner. She's also very clear about the fact that she's not willing to become codependent. I do think that in cases when one partner has an illness, that there can be a pause in the relationship. Somebody who has an alcohol problem or a drug problem, or I knew a couple several years ago, the woman was really struggling with an eating disorder to the degree that her partner said, look, I love you and I cannot live with you while you're actively engaged with this disease. You have to heal yourself.
Right.
And when you do, if you can, you know, I'll be there for you. We can explore again this relationship. And I think that there's a really compassionate way to be a friend to somebody. I mean, I really think at the core of any true love is that deep friendship. And maybe it's time for this letter writer to sort of step back and offer that hand of friendship to her partner and ask him if he can, you know, do some work to heal himself. You know, maybe he's not going to come all the way, you know, the whole distance. He's not going to lose this anxiety disorder, but certainly manage it better.
Right. No, in fact, she owes it to herself and to him to be perfectly honest right now in this moment about what she's feeling.
Right.
Which is, look, I get that this is serious. If we're going to move forward, you have to recognize that I am not going to be in the role of your ancillary or support. That's not sustainable for me. There is a reason that people need help outside the context of their relationship. We have the feeling that love is this island and people should just be able to supply everything to one another. But when there's this kind of profound suffering and actual biochemical stuff happening, it's bigger than that. You know, struggling, you're appropriating this role of having to talk him down. Actually, you need to be able to be his girlfriend and the person who's the love of his life. And he needs to recognize that there is paid professional help that will help him talk through some of the stuff, because it's clearly an acute episode. He's been managing it okay, and for the last year, he's really had a downturn. This is precisely the moment where you have to swoop in, and we know this from Robert Lowell or any of the great depressive writers, David Foster Wallace. It's cyclical, and a good spouse is the person who says, when things start to turn dark, hey, I'm here, I hear you, but we also need to have a plan and an open line of communication about what you're suffering with so that I take on the burden I need to take, but no more than that. I think that the business about his coming from a privileged background, I mean, she says, you know, he hasn't dealt with a great deal of hardship. He's dealing with mental illness. So that I think the class part of it is sort of taking the place of a fundamental fear. This person isn't strong enough, and I'm going to have to be strong for both of us. And he does need to hear that she's anxious about that, not because of his background, but because of his biochemistry.
Well, I think, you know, when she says that, I mean, she does mention his background, you're right, but she's also mentioning what lies ahead.
Right.
You know, difficulties that we encounter in our lives as we have children and get jobs and lose jobs and make money and lose money and, you know, all of the stresses of life, of adult life. And, you know, I think that she's being really smart. One of the best pieces of advice I feel like I ever have to give anyone when they have a dilemma such as this or really any number of dilemmas is, you know, what's it going to be like in 10 years? We have received countless letters from the person who is 10 years out on this.
Yep.
The person who says, you know, I met my wife or my husband, my partner, you know, when we met, they were vibrant and loving and fun and amazing. And then they have been struggling with this or that for the last decade. And I'm miserable because I was codependent and I stuck by him or stood with her. And now I'm so unhappy. I don't know what to do with myself. And the advice we have to give is you have to save yourself. You have to detach from this dependency so you can have the life that you deserve. And, you know, obviously we live life with compassion. We don't leave people the moment they're in their hour of need. But this seems like more than an hour of need.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, they're at a place in their relationship where they're not in so deep that permanent or nothing's permanent, I guess, but the big decisions have been made.
Right.
You know, they don't have a child together. They aren't married to
Bingo.
Each other.
Yeah.
They haven't done the in sickness and in health. For better or worse.
Right.
I think ultimately when we say, well, what kills the deal is, will it make you miserable? Will it make you uncomfortable? Will it make you sad? Will it make you suffer? Life is hard enough. You don't need to bind yourself to somebody who will do all of those things to you.
Without even meaning to. I mean, the struggle here is that this is a guy who's not trying to be weak or be self-involved. He's in the grip of an illness and
right.
he needs to manage it. And the question is, well, what are your needs then? You share them with the person you're with and you make sure that you get the reaction you need to. Because otherwise, you're absolutely right. 5 years down the road, 5 months down the road, she could be in a state of profound anguish, having just gotten married and realizing I have made a big mistake.
Right. So struggling, I think that you don't have to struggle so hard. This is your boyfriend's journey, and you need to let him have it. And forgive yourself, release yourself, love him in the ways that you can love him without compromising your own life, your own right to happiness.
Right.
Good luck struggling, and good luck to your partner as well. To try to save somebody, it's the road to destruction. It's the road to sorrow.
Right.
Our inbox is full of letters from people who have tried to do just that.
Right.
Some of them we'll be talking about in future episodes, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Dear Sugar, around 6 months ago, a man I've always loved passed away. He was in a car that swerved off the highway, flipped over into a river, and he drowned. It was horrific and sudden, and he was only 24. I had loved this man, Josh, for the last 3 years. I met him in college when I was only 20 and newly out of a 4-year relationship. He helped me rebuild my self-esteem and learn to be happy in the moment. We had a summer fling that lasted a little over a month. This guy was a well-known partier and player, but since it was summer, we were in our sleepy college town alone and were able to get to know each other on a deeper level. He got me, and I got him. He was a constant in my life. I moved away. We stayed in touch. However, our friendship was still sometimes clouded with once. Me saying that I would wait for him. Him telling me the same thing. Until I met my now boyfriend, Tom. Tom is great. He is my future. We live together. We're happy. He is who I want in my life for the long haul. I had finally moved on when Josh died. The hardest thing about Josh's death was that I would never get the confirmation of love that I always needed from him. Our relationship that was built on a constant, what if in the future, was over with no ending. It was almost unbearable. Which brings me to my problem, Sugar. Tom got jealous, like crazy jealous, when Josh died. He didn't know how to handle it. He had to constantly get reassurance from me about my emotions, tell me how upset he was about how I was acting, and that he couldn't stand the thought that Josh would now have, quote, a constant place in my heart. I spent the majority of the time that I should have been processing my emotions about Josh, worrying that I was going to lose Tom. That felt really unfair to me. It was so hard, Sugar. I went to therapy to deal with my emotions. My therapist told me I should confront Tom, and a few nights ago I did. Tom told me that I was being selfish, that Josh's death affected him as much as it affected me, since he thought he might lose me. Sugar, I don't even understand how I should feel about this. How can I work towards putting all of this behind us? Our relationship has already started fraying because of it. Help me, please. Signed, Grieving, Lonely, and Hurt.
You know, when I read this letter, I immediately thought of this short story, maybe one of the most famous short stories in the English language, The Story of the Dead by James Joyce.
Beautiful story.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful story, and there's this line in it where the main character, who's this guy named Gabriel Conroy, sees his wife, and his wife is staring out through a window. It's at a dinner party, and she's clearly really upset. She's heard a beautiful song, and it's made her very upset. And it turns out that his wife has remembered a young boy who she loved in her youth in Galway, but he died tragically young. And what this guy, Gabriel Conroy, is experiencing is that he's feels in competition with a ghost, in a sense. He says he longed to be master of her strange mood. He longed to be master of her strange mood. I hope that you, grieving, lonely, and hurt, will think about this as you're trying to be sympathetic towards your new boyfriend. He is trying to understand and process the fact that you deeply loved another man who has now been taken from the earth and, in a certain sense, in that way, kind of commemorated in an irrevocable way as one of the great loves, maybe the great love of your life. The crisis that the boyfriend is in is exactly what Gabriel Conroy is expressing in The Dead. How do I compete with a love that's now gone and that is therefore sort of idealized? It's removed. It becomes the ultimate unattainable relationship after which so many people seek.
You know, I feel a lot of compassion for both of them, both the letter writer and Tom. And of course, for Josh, I mean, how devastating that he lost his life so young. But here are these people who he's left in his wake. One's a stranger to him, in love with the woman he may or may not have loved. They're both in a situation that feels impossible. You know, the letter writer has this enormous grief, and she has a right to that grief. And really the healthy thing for her to do is to express that grief. And Tom has a right to his feelings, you know, to be heartbroken that his girlfriend is heartbroken over another man.
Right. A certain part of us says, well, look, it's about her and her grief. But he's sitting there saying, wait a second, I get you loved him, but you love me too. And I'm here. You know,
right.
Somehow what he's picked up on is what she's revealed here, which is that she held a torch for him. What do you do when the grieving process also is a kind of betrayal?
Right.
And I know she doesn't intend it that way, but from the boyfriend's point of view, from Gabriel Conroy's point of view, gazing up at his wife in front of that window, seeing her in such a state of emotion that he's never elicited from her.
I have a dear friend, the writer Susie Vitello, and she experienced a big loss early in her life. I think we should call her up. She recently wrote a novel called The Moment Before that she wrote really after years of grappling with the nature of grief and its impact on subsequent relationships. I'd love to call her up and invite her in on this conversation.
Let's do it.
Hi.
Hi, Susie. This is Cheryl, and Steve Almond is on the line too.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, you guys, for inviting me to participate.
It's dark terrain, but we wanted to talk over this tough letter that we received.
We've just been discussing, you know, what kind of counsel we can offer this woman.
Yeah, specifically because it's fraying her relationship. Her grieving, you know, for young guy who died is devastating to the new boyfriend.
Well, how could she not be grieving? You know, it's so devastating when somebody so young suddenly dies, and especially with, it sounds like, this woman hasn't had complete closure in her relationship with him.
That's right.
And she's now bringing, you know, all of those sort of emotional fragments to her new relationship. And that's really hard. I had a husband who died, and he died at 25, suddenly, in a car accident.
How many years ago was that your first husband died?
Well, I can tell you exactly because it was 4 days before my daughter was born and she's going to be 27. The good news is that our relationships with people who have died actually evolve as, you know, as you go on in life, and the things that make it evolve and have you grow in the relationship with the deceased person are new relationships and new circumstances. But it takes time.
Right.
Totally. It does. I mean, I tell you, I had a boyfriend who appeared out of nowhere. He was a college boyfriend. And at the time that my husband Frank died, I didn't know anybody who didn't know me as Frank's wife. And, you know, I had these two babies and all that. So my identity was as a widow, like instantly, you
right.
know, this poor widow and this mom of these two babies. And I almost started to believe the fiction of myself, you know. I just lost who I was. And then I get this phone call from this old boyfriend. Like, not only did he not know that I had been widowed, he didn't even know that I had been married.
So it was almost like your former self. He knew the person you used to be before your great loss.
So what my relationship with him became was this way to get back into myself, you know, figure out who the hell I still am. Besides a widow. And he woke me back up again, and he brought me back into myself. But then, you know, after several months of this, he actually looked me in the eye one day, and he said, correct me if I'm wrong, but nothing actually happened to you, did it? You know?
Wow.
Absolutely stunned. Like, what? You know? But then I realized over the years, not then, but over the years, I realized how I had turned to this young man who was not emotionally mature at all, you know, turned to him to be my savior and to kind of understand me and help me through my grief. And I didn't really consider what he might want in a relationship, you know, really. And it took me many false starts with other love to finally sort of reach this idea that Frank, my husband, my first husband, will be eternally this 25-year-old in my mind, but my perspective to it, you know, has shifted and changed over time. So, you know, I think she should give it time, and I think that she should not feel too hasty in her need for Tom to, first of all, be her therapist. Tom is not her therapist. He's her lover. He's her boyfriend. And I think that she should, you know, actively participate in things that are celebrating who she is now, you know, not who she was, you know, a few years ago when she was with Josh. And, you know, practicing acknowledging the fact that this man loves her and is threatened by her sort of outward grieving and wishing and you know, it almost feels like she has not really sought closure.
Well, let me ask you this, Susie.
Yeah.
One of the things that the letter writer says is that her boyfriend is threatened that she'll always have a place in her heart for this old love. What I'm curious about with you is, do you have a place in your heart for Frank? And how has that played out in the various relationships you've had over the last 27 years with different men? I mean, have they been threatened by it? How do you... Is it a secret you keep yourself, or is it something that you share with the men you've loved?
Well, when I say that your relationship with a dead person evolves, you know, what I mean by that is that as you mature emotionally, the place in your heart that person dwells is part of that process of maturation. And so at a certain point, it was so integrated into my being that person who was once my husband and who died tragically just absorbed into me and has become part of who I am. And my lovers that I've had, you know, I've been married now for 6 years. And by the time I arrived in that relationship, that was almost 20 years after this had happened. And I think it was just then, you know, 20 years later, that I actually had a healthy perspective on how we're all connected, even in life and death, you know, and that it actually made, I think, me more empathetic and more of a good partner for a potential good partner to be in relationship with. So, you know, before that, though, yes, there were relationships where men were very threatened by the fact that I, you know, I had the guy's last name and I had pictures of our wedding all over the place and, you know, all of that.
It's so wonderful to get your counsel, Susie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Susie.
Great to hear you guys, too. I'm so glad you're doing this.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
I mean, the fact that this woman is writing to us, instead, they haven't thrown in the towel yet, this couple.
That's right.
It speaks to their strength. It speaks to their genuine bond. And I think, in fairness to the letter writer, she says, Tom is my future. I love him. You know, she. It wasn't when Josh died, it wasn't as if she realized he was the one she loved.
The question is she saying it to him, right? Because this is what he needs to hear. You are here. And I'm not the person who pines after somebody who's not available. You have helped me become the person who loves somebody who's available. And I am in deep anguish and pain, but you're my future. So help me through it.
Right. I keep coming back to this phrase that the letter writer used, that Tom was threatened by the fact that Josh would forever have a place in the letter writer's heart. And one of the things, when we get really big, when we really love with a deep generosity of spirit, what we can do is love all the people who made the people we love who they are. And Josh is one of those people for this letter writer, it seems. You know, so maybe at the end of this, you know, Tom and the letter writer come through this together, and Tom ultimately has a little place in his heart for Josh too. As somebody who, you know, was important to this woman who's so important to him.
James Joyce is talking in The Dead about all these different things, but he's also saying that the living and the dead are all connected. The same snow faintly falls on the living and the dead. We have this tendency to think like Gabriel thinks, better pass boldly into that other world in the full glory of some passion than fade and wither dismally with age. That's what he says. But actually, it's better if you can manage it to be alive. And it's better to find, you know, in terms of relationships that can really sustain you, other people who are there and are present. And it's beautiful to honor every relationship that you've had. And some, unfortunately, people pass away from us. But I don't think we age dismally. I don't think we wither. I think the idea is that we keep growing and getting more vital and bigger in our love, if possible. It's unclear where grieving, lonely, and hurt, where you are on this journey. But the idea is that your love gets bigger. The longer you have the privilege of being alive on Earth, the larger you hope, anyway, your love is going to get.
And we wish you luck on the journey.
Absolutely.
Oh, but your love is such a swamp. You don't think before you jump. And I said I wouldn't get sucked in. This is the last time.
So, Cheryl, I have another question that is a very unusual deal killer sort of question. Are you ready?
I think so.
You're sitting down. That's good.
I'm alarmed at the word unusual. You only bring out the big guns when you mean business.
Well, let's just get started here. Dear Sugars, my problem will probably shock you, as I've certainly shocked myself. I'm 31 years old, and I recently started a promising relationship with a girl whom I love very much. I really want to make it work. However, I have a secret that, if it got out, would destroy my relationship and create a ripple effect in other areas of my life as well. I have a pregnancy fetish that, up until this year, I never acted upon. Several months ago, I met a woman who serves as a gestational surrogate for couples who cannot conceive on their own. She uses sperm donors she finds online. After corresponding with this woman for the better part of a year and going on a few dates with her, she told me that she wanted me to be her next donor. I realized it was a terrible idea, but somehow I let my sexual fantasies get the better of me, and we had sex without using protection. Now she is pregnant. Thankfully, she already has a couple lined up who want to adopt the baby. The couple prefers not to learn my identity, so I'll be an anonymous donor. It's a huge relief. I fully intend to have kids of my own someday, hopefully with a person whom I love and respect. But I am mortified by my own behavior and fear that I will dwell on what I've done for the rest of my life. It's impossible for me to share this secret with my girlfriend, my parents, or even my friends, which means that I'll carry it with me to the end of my days. I've always thought of myself as an honest person, but this secret is simply too dangerous to share. Is it possible to come to terms with my mistake in a meaningful way? Sincerely, remorseful. Now, I have to say, Cheryl, I have to be honest, I found this question very confusing. The nature of his, I mean, when we hear pregnancy fetish, certainly I think, okay, somebody who's...
Wants to have sex with a woman who's pregnant.
Correct, right, which I completely understand. I'm not, maybe not the level of fetish, but I get it. It's very sexy to me. But this is something else. This has to do with an obsessive thought about the possibility of impregnating somebody.
Right.
So that's what his fetish is. It isn't a woman who's pregnant. It's making a woman pregnant.
But, you know, I want to say what the letter writer is asking is kind of something different. It's not, is this fetish okay or am I okay? It's like, what do I do with a secret? He says he absolutely cannot share. You know, he speaks in very strong terms that it will destroy his life.
Right.
He doesn't ask, should he keep the secret, does he? Is he asking our advice about that? Because I'll tell you, I'm not in favor of him keeping the secret. You know, when I first met Brian, and we fell madly in love, and we had been together, you know, 8 or 10 months at this point. So now we were not just madly in love, but like, you know, kind of had reached this place of, you know, we were quite serious.
Yeah.
And Brian is a filmmaker, and he went off, we you know, lived in Portland, Oregon. He went off to New York for a month to make a movie. And he asked me if I would house sit for him. So I was, you know, the serious girlfriend who was like, you know, living in her boyfriend's house. One day I was just sort of wandering around the house, and there was a bookshelf that was kind of in the hallway outside of his housemate's room, and I found a self-help book on the shelf. I don't remember the exact title, but it was something like, you know, what do you do if your mom's a sex addict? You know, something like this.
That kind of self-help book.
Yeah. Right. And it's a sort of compelling title. So I picked it up. And inside the book was written, you know, on the sort of dedication page was written a letter to Brian from the authors of the book. And the authors of the book have a facility in Southern Oregon, a sort of sex addict rehab center that works with people who have had sexually inappropriate relationships with family members, incest. And I read this letter, you know, from the authors addressed to Brian. And it said, you know, Brian, you and your mom have just done such great work and you've made such great progress. And it became clear to me that the authors of the book were congratulating this man I was deeply in love with on essentially like healing the sexual relationship he'd had with his mother. And I was so, like, I remember even just telling you this now. I'll just tell you the story has a happy ending.
Good. Yeah, I think so.
I'm sorry to alarm you.
It's kind of intense early relationship stuff.
And I mean, just telling you now, like, my hands are getting cold and my heart is beating because I suddenly realized that I knew this horrible secret about this person I thought I knew and I thought I was going to spend my life with.
And he didn't tell you.
And he didn't tell me. Yeah. And I spent the day in his house just weeping and really going through sort of a grieving process. And one of the things that was so interesting to me, we're talking about these deal killers. And what I realized by the end of the day, this whole torturous day where I couldn't reach him, was that it actually, astonishingly, didn't kill the deal for me that I believed that he'd had, you know, sexual relations with his mother. It was that he hadn't shared that history with me. Now, of course, the end of the story is he didn't have sexual relationship with his mother. It was a prank that had been played on him by friends who had written this and planted the book.
Oh, my God. How did the conversation go, though?
Oh, my. No, this is, you know, it's sort of one of these crazy things. No, we broke up. Like, I broke up with Brian over this because he could not convince me that it was a prank because it was this, like, long time release prank that it was played by his friend Andy Brown, and they have this whole history of pranking each other, which now, you know, I know to be true. But it even, like, I had to get, like, a handwriting sample from his friend Andy Brown before I would believe because the prank was so well done.
So crazy. Wow.
That I actually, for a day or like a couple of days, you know, Brian and I had a huge meltdown because I thought that this secret had been revealed. But what was really kind of beautiful about it, like in retrospect, when I think about it, I mean, what it revealed to me, I mean, that's the thing about deal killers. We don't know what's going to kill the deal. Okay. Right. Because we imagine, like so many people, if you ask them, you know, before they get married, they'll say, well, infidelity is the deal breaker for me. And then, you know, lo and behold, 12 years in, somebody cheats on somebody and then they decide to work it out. It's not a deal killer.
Right.
What you find is, you know, different things will kill the deal. And what I found in this crazy, what now became like a funny experience in the end, but I experienced it as not a joke. I experienced it as the truth.
Yeah.
And what was revealed to me is what killed the deal was Brian's, what I believed was his deceit. And not just his deceit, but his keeping an essential piece of himself from me. Because I think intimacy, romantic love, that kind of love is about showing each other the essential self.
Disclosure,
we do that. Yeah. We do that with so few people.
Right.
And so, you know, what I say to this man who's written to us with a pregnancy fetish is he is robbing himself of really deep love if he doesn't reveal this aspect of his desire, his history, his experience, his shame, his guilt, and work it out with that person who will show him that she can love him anyway. You know, what are some ways that he can actually bring his genuine desires into that relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Can I also just be a kind of condescending 46-year-old too?
Please.
This guy's 31.
Oh,
and
my
here's,
God.
Right. And what are you, 47? Are you 47?
90.
You're 90?
But you were close.
But, you know, what I want to say too is, okay, most of our listeners who are like over the age of 40 will be nodding their heads right now. They'll be saying, yes, you know, you do mature in so many ways through your 30s. And one of them is you come to realize that all kinds of crazy stuff goes on in our minds when it comes to sex. And, you know, we just need to forgive ourselves for it.
Right.
And that, you know, it's actually a much better idea to, you know, let the light in, let the air in, say what we're thinking, say what we're feeling, you know, reveal to the people who we trust the things we can trust them with, true selves.
Right. He says, I have serious regrets about fathering children with a woman for purely sexual reasons. Well, let yourself off the hook, dude.
Yeah.
Lots of men feel that way.
Yeah.
Guess what? Evolution actually designed you to really want to get women pregnant. That's the way that evolution actually designed your body, get off on getting a woman pregnant so that your genes were going to be there in the next generation.
And I think he did really due diligence. He got like the one woman on the planet who to get pregnant somebody who didn't want anything to do with the kid.
Yeah, actually, you did a great job. What matters isn't the deed. It's the feelings that led to the deed and the possibility that those still exist.
Well, and this is why I go back to, I think he's too decent for his own good. Like, I think he does. He has a sense of honor and decency that's at odds with these actions. Frankly, you know, I keep saying he should tell this woman he's dating or you know, future partners about this. And this isn't to say that those women aren't going to have a negative reaction to it.
Right.
You know, it might be a deal killer for them.
Yeah.
But maybe one of his deal killers should be, I need to find a woman who's willing to love me for who I am.
Right.
And let's make sense of this. Let's make sense of this desire you have that makes you feel uncomfortable with yourself.
Tell me, baby, have you had
We've come to the end of another Dear Sugar podcast. I have important things that I need to tell you. Dear Sugar is produced by WBUR in Boston. Our producer is the wonderful Lisa Tobin. This week's show was recorded at Mississippi Studios in beautiful Portland, Oregon. And thanks to Jim Brunberg. New episodes of Dear Sugar are released bi-weekly, and we will begin airing weekly later this year. Each episode, we answer a handful of questions asked by you, and we want your questions. You can send your letters to Dear Sugar @gmail.com. We would love to hear from all of you.
No, no, no. Don't send your questions to dearsugar@gmail.com. It's dearsugarradio@gmail.com. That is, again, dearsugarradio@gmail.com.
We would love to hear from any or all of you who are brave and foolish enough to write.
Thank you. Can I just say my favorite, I know that we can't see this on the radio, on the podcast, but my favorite moment, you know, of all of this talking we've done to date is the look on your face when for about 2 minutes you believed that my husband had sex with his mother.
Yes. It was just, I just thought to myself, wow, that's some pretty heavy sledding there.
My poor mother-in-law is not aware, I don't believe, of this prank.
Hi, Mom.
Sorry, Joan. I'm sorry, Joan. But I hope she's always been known for her great sense of humor. So let's hope she laughs. Just for the record, there was no hanky-panky between the mother and child there.
Oh, my God.